On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the summer of 1920, the British Empire, the superpower of its day, came down hard on tiny Ireland and the Irish separatist movement. And Irish guerrilla fighters, the Irish Republican Army, hit back hard and suffered in return. A powerful new film by British director Ken Loach, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, tells the story of that fight with deep sympathy for the Irish and a political message for the American superpower today. It won top prize at Cannes. It's won the fury of British right-wingers. Up next on Point, director Ken Loach on power, resistance, and his film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Joining me now from London is director Ken Loach. He's made more than 20 films over four decades, including Kez, My Name is Joe, and Sweet 16. The Wind That Shakes the Barley is his latest work. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes and is now in theaters around the United States. Ken Loach, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you and good to have you. There's so much we want to talk about in this hour, but I wish we could impose on you to share some of this story with us. This film is not opening everywhere in the United States. We'll have listeners who know this Irish history like the back of their hands and others who won't know it at all. I wish you'd just give us the setting for The Wind That Shakes the Barley, the sort of historical setting and what you're telling in this film.
Yes, well, it's the film is set during the War of Independence in Ireland, and there was a long... Ireland was a colony of the British for centuries, many centuries.
Of course.
Since
mm-hmm.
shortly after the Norman invasion. And there'd been an independence movement for 200 years. Mm-hmm. The United Irishmen in the end of the 18th century was a high point. Throughout the 19th century, there were movements for independence. People will know of the Easter Rising in 1916.
Mm-hmm. In Dublin.
In Dublin, but it was intended to be across Ireland, but it failed. Then the Irish people were granted a parliament in their first parliament, the first Doyle. They voted overwhelmingly for independence. A completely independent, united Ireland was what they voted for by 75% or more.
With Sinn Féin winning a majority there, Sinn Féin, of course, meaning what? Ourselves alone.
Ourselves alone, yes. And the British response to that was to close down the Parliament, to close the papers that supported it, and to say, you're not having independence. And then they sent in more troops, and that was met with resistance by the people in guerrilla units called flying columns. And then that was the War of Independence, and it lasted until, and I always get mixed up, I think it's at the end of 21. And a treaty was proposed by the British.
Mm-hmm.
It was a ceasefire. The treaty was proposed by the British, which meant the partitioning of Ireland. The MPs, the Irish MPs, would have to swear an oath of allegiance to the king, which, of course, is what they'd been fighting against, that Ireland would stay within the British Empire. And it would have a kind of dominion status, but only a part of the country.
So a partition that would carve out the north as it's still carved out today.
Yes.
And an independence that really wasn't full independence. And that, as you vividly portray in the film, split the Irish resistance, including the two brothers
yes.
you put at the center of The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Yes. And the terms of the treaty were very carefully judged. I mean, the British politicians like Churchill and Lord George showed their cunning, but not necessarily their wisdom, because they pitched the treaty in such a way, the terms in such a way, that they knew it would divide the Republican movement. And they armed the side they favoured to kill the side they didn't.
Mm.
And, of course, they got what they wanted. But the legacy of nearly a century of pain and killing and warfare and suppression of human rights and military occupation that the North has suffered is down to that treaty.
The unwinding of wrongs done, portrayed in its complexity and pain here. I saw the film over the weekend and people left the theater in tears. It's very strong. It's very
political. Let's hear just a little bit from early on when one of the brothers, the younger brother Damien, who's been in training to be a doctor, is a doctor. He's supposed to go off to London. Instead, his friends are calling him, and his brother are calling him to stay back and fight. They've just seen one of their great friends, Michal, killed by the British Black and Tans. We'll talk about that. Here's a clip from The Wind That Shakes the Barley, where he asks, what are we supposed to do, pick up our gaming sticks, our hurling sticks, to confront this mighty empire?
How many British soldiers in the country, Tim?
Too many.
How many?
There's about 10,000, Damien.
10,000?
Mm-hmm.
Tans?
Mm-hmm.
Artillery units? Machine gun corps? Cavalry?
And many police. More besides. What's your point, Damien?
It's young men like me all we're talking about, Teddy. Yeah.
Michal is a real Irishman, Damien.
You're a coward, Damien.
I'm a coward. And you're a hero, is it, Ned? And you're going to take on the British Empire with your hurley. Is that it? Stun the bastards.
For Christ's sake, Damien. What about Michal?
Look at Michal. He was killed because he wouldn't say his name in English. Is that what you call a martyr, Teddy, is it?
So we should all buy a one-way ticket to London. Is that it, Damien?
Of course, in the end, he doesn't. And they do take on the British Empire, at least a little corner of it, in Ireland. Ken Loach, that empire and the war that has just ended, World War One, it just recently ended in 1920, of course, very much the backdrop here. Irishmen who've come home from fighting in that war, trained in military tactics, and for that matter, the recruits for the Black and Tan brought over from Britain to keep the Irish down, very much schooled in World War One as well.
Yes, there weren't so many. Obviously, some Irish did fight. I mean, most of the people who fought for independence weren't ex-military. They would have ex-military amongst them and leading them. Mm. But the Tans and the auxiliaries were almost Germanic soldiers. The Black and Tans were auxiliaries for the police.
These are known by the color of their uniform. These are brought over from from London and all over Britain.
From all over Britain.
To bring the hammer down.
They returned from the First World War. They were promised a land fit for heroes. In fact, they faced unemployment. They faced not a good future. And so when the chance for to being recruited to pursue the only trade they knew, which was soldiering, came up, of course some would go along with it. The auxiliaries, who were similar to the Tans in that they were to supplement the police, but they were in fact all officers. They were the most brutal of the lot. I mean, their reputation was horrific, and they were paid a lot of money. A lot of money to go, and they were the most ruthless of all the groups that went to suppress the Irish. Mm.
And of course, what you finally bring to the fore here is the pain that the Irish resistance itself has to go through. First of all, to gain unanimity, and then when they get a piece of what they want, the pain of breaking up over that very painfully. Even brothers. Never easy finding resolution, working out this unwinding after the deed is done, after the wrong.
Yeah. Well, there was a logic on both sides, really. From those who wanted to accept it, they said, well, this is as good as we're going to get. It's a platform to move on, to unite the country, because nobody thought the north of Ireland would be sustainable on its own. So it was a platform to unite the country, to move on, to get out of the empire, if that's what the people wanted, and to really get all they wanted. On the other side, people were saying, well, we are so close to getting a united Ireland now. If we don't pursue it now, we will never again gather our strength as we have now. So you could see there was a logic on both sides.
Mm. Margaret's calling from Douglas, Massachusetts. Margaret, you're on the air with director Ken Loach.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I haven't seen the movie yet, but this just brings so much back. My grandfather was in the IRA, in the rebellion. My mother, many times, and aunts described their fear, the Black and Tans coming, dragging him out, the mother, you know, hiding the kids, and him being dropped back. There were four brothers, two of them left and came to America, and two of them stayed to make sure De Valera got into, you know, elected. Mm. We grew up never even knowing that we had two uncles in America because the split was just that great.
Margaret,
we have, yep.
Well, I just wonder, when you look around the world today, does this story still resonate for you in other conflicts now, or is this Irish history past and gone, remembered within the family? Does it have political relevance to you today? Ken Loach has drawn a line to Iraq. We'll talk about that. Do you?
I do. The splitting of people along lines that are so deep and so powerful, things that people experience and then other people try to put meaning to. You know, my grandfather, I believe, joined. He tried to marry my grandmother, and the lord whose land he worked said he'd sooner sow the seed, the field with salt than raise papists on the land. That drove him for a number of reasons to fight. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows us that there are people fighting for reasons that I don't think we can always understand.
Margaret, thank you for the family history and the perspective. Ken Loach, I'm reading here in the Irish Times, it says, Ken Loach is a national treasure. It just seems that the nation that produced him is not always keen to treasure him. You've had some tremendous kickback from the conservative press on this thing. Red Ken, I mean, they go after you. They're saying, you know, why does he hate his country? Leech off his country. You've been compared by the conservative British press to Leni Riefenstahl, the filmmaker for Hitler here. Why such a fierce pushback?
Well, it is extraordinary, and when you quote it, it just shows how absurd it is. I mean, if you challenge the idea that the British Empire is anything other than a charitable institution, then they go for you, because the notion of the empire as a benevolent, something benevolent, is very dear to the right-wing hearts, and of course it wasn't anything of the sort. I mean, it was based on slavery, as we know, and exploitation and violence. So I think it's really important. It's very important that the British people acknowledge what their ruling class did over the centuries. And the other thing is, if you challenge the role of the British Army or the British military, again, that's something that they defend to the death, because the idea that the British soldiers could do anything or could be allowed or instructed to behave in a violent way against civilians is something that they cannot tolerate. They can't tolerate the idea. And yet, of course, we've seen what happened in Iraq in terms of the ill treatment of prisoners there.
You open it with a sledgehammer on that front. I mean, young Irish guys hurling, playing, it's kind of like a field hockey game, we'd call it, traditional Irish game, and then ending up before a cottage with absolutely brutal black and tan platoon all over them, one who refuses to speak English, beaten to an absolute pulp as everyone sobs. You know, we've kind of gotten used to a little more, misty treatment of this kind of encounter. You reject that. You go straight
surely,
at it.
Surely not. I mean, I've seen a few American war films. I think they're much bloodier than ours, to be honest.
Well, yes, but that's usually, it's true. But it's kind of like, all-out fighting, here we go. This, you take it down to a very specific individual wrapped in ropes, beaten and bloody. It's more politically charged than spectacle-oriented.
Yes, well, it's not a spectacle. You don't actually see him beaten. I mean, you hear him, and you see the consequence. But that was the reality. I mean, we could have been much more extreme in what we showed. But that was the reality. And when the lad refuses to speak English, it's a political act. I mean, he knows that he's courting disaster, and it's a gesture of defiance. And the other boys around him are saying, you know, come on, don't be a fool, just say what they want to hear. But he's determined to stand on principle that his own language is, he can speak his own language in his own land.
You can feel in that moment, the tension is so thick, and the fear really on both sides. The black and tan have the upper hand with their weapons, but They're very well aware of the loathing that they're up against there. I mean, part of the, I guess, the criticism out of the right in London, what is it? Is it also that you're not showing sympathy for the human predicament of the black and tans set out?
You know, it's funny, isn't it? We've done all those films about Germany in the Second World War. Yeah. When have you ever heard them say, let's hear it for the Nazis?
Right.
It's very funny, isn't it? You know, but once the British state is put in the dock, then they say, oh, you must be fair. But actually, in the other clip that you played in that scene, the officer says, these men have been in the trenches of the First World War. What do you expect? And the officer himself breaks down in that scene and can't deal with it. And they're actually let out of prison by a Scottish soldier, a British soldier who happens to be Scottish.
Mm-hmm. Says, I won't have your blood on my hands.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you see, they're not presented in the way the right wing would have you believe.
And yet the hammer comes down and comes down and comes down, and the response is, well, let's listen to a little more here. Here's after ambushing and killing two truckloads of British troops. The leader of the Irish volunteers asserts to his men that they will meet British terror with their own terror.
Attention! Hop, hop, hop. Rough business, boys. Filthy job. Now, look again. I'm going to show you something. Look! Look! To your right! Look to your right! Mercenaries who were paid to come over to make us crawl and to wipe us out. Here's what we've done. We've sent a message to the British cabinet that will echo and reverberate around the world. If they bring their savagery over here, we will meet it with a savagery of our own.
Savagery meets savagery in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Director Ken Loach is with us. Dawn is calling from Boston. Hi, Dawn, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Loach. How are you?
Hello. Hi.
I'm actually the producer of the Boston Irish Film Festival, and I had the pleasure of seeing the film last year in Galway, and hearing those scenes are actually making me get very emotional, obviously. Mm. My great-grandfather and, of course, all of my uncles were in the First World War and came home and fought for Ireland, and I do feel that there is an analogy with Iraq, Tom. I don't think anyone can understand unless their family have been through it. And I think with Iraq, I think the Iraqis are the only ones who understand what's going on over there. We can talk about it till the cows come home, but unless you are Irish, you understand what Mr. Loach is portraying in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And with Iraq, I think it's the same way.
But how do you see the analogy? You know, Americans see Saddam Hussein, a tyrant, toppled with the by American guns, and Americans felt pretty good about it at that point.
Sorry, is that to Mr. Loach or to me?
No, go ahead.
Well, to both, but you first, perhaps, Don.
Well, I think that, you know, you always see the big picture and there is always the bad guy, but at the end of the day, it's the people who suffer. And it's how you do it. And not to get too political, but I think George Bush went into Iraq for other issues other than getting Saddam Hussein. It was all about oil. I think if they had stayed with Afghanistan, they would have been fine. And I think with Britain and Ireland, with Britain, it was all about economics in the north of Ireland, getting the cotton industry, et cetera. So I think, you know, everybody has a reason for it. I just don't think that with Mr. Bush, it was necessarily just to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Ken Loach, are you with Dawn on that interpretation? What do you say?
No, absolutely. I agree with you, Dawn. You see, I think the reasons where the British were in Ireland was that it was cheap food and it was cheap labour. And the reasons the Americans and the British have followed them into Iraq, again, was economic. They wanted the oil. They also wanted into the industries and the public-owned companies that the Americans tried to privatize as soon as they were in. And they want political and economic dominance in that area. I think that's why they're in. If you want to get rid of a dictator, well, the Americans don't have a very good history of getting rid of dictators. They've actually dealt with them pretty well. But the international community has to act. You can't have a vigilante just storming around the world, shooting up whoever they think. You know, we have to. The moment we remove ourselves from international law, I think we're in trouble.
Don, thanks for your call. Ken Loach, let's put your politics right out on the table here to understand the full context, because it comes in the film as well. It's not just a fight for independence, but there's clearly portrayed and articulated here a fight for, on behalf of some of the guerrillas, I guess, in the film, for a different kind of economic system. They don't just want to be free from the United Kingdom, from the empire. They want to be free from capitalism as they've known it. The Globe and Mail in Canada calls you the world's most persistent socialist movie maker. Is that your line of connection to this story? How important do you see that sub-theme running through The Wind That Shakes the Barley?
I think it's very important, Tom. When colonies become independent, one thing that is always on the agenda when colonies gain their independence is what kind of country can we make? You know, what kind of society can we build out of the mess that the imperialist has left? And a very strong part of that discussion in Ireland was that strand led by James Connolly in 1916 and before, who said that the cause of Ireland is the cause of Labour and the cause of Labour is the cause of Ireland. Mm. In other words, it had to be a change to benefit everyone, not just to change the colour of the flag or paint the telephone, the post boxes a different colour. Mm. And I think that was a very important element in it, and it's actually enshrined in the proclamation and in the founding document of the first parliament. Mm. And there was a social program which put the public good before private greed.
But of course, it didn't ultimately go that way, and now Ireland's doing pretty darn well, thank you. We'll talk about that, but I want to hear the way it's depicted in the film, if we may. Ken Loach, here's a clip where brothers Teddy and Damien O'Donovan, Porrick Delaney playing Teddy here, and Killian Murphy, they're fighting about the future, talking, debating the future of Ireland. Teddy supports the treaty with the British government, while Damien feels the other way. He's disgusted with his brother's decision.
Look, Teddy, there's 1 in 4 people out of work in this country, right? I have seen children and families starving. Do we expect them to head off to New York and London like before? Is that what we fought for?
We didn't fight for this, Damien.
Look, it's too late. You're not going to convince
me. You've always been a dreamer,
Damien. I am not a dreamer. I am a realist, Teddy.
I need you with me on this, Damien. I swear we'll tear up the treaty once we're strong enough, but I need you to be with me on this. Just give me time. Give this a chance.
It's too late, Teddy.
Dreamer versus realist in The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and it does not end well. But who's the dreamer and who's the realist here, Ken Loach? Ireland now, famously, the Celtic Tiger, its economy been booming for a decade and more now. Does it give you pause to rethink? Maybe it's good that the socialist path wasn't taken.
Well, For many decades, Ireland stayed backward, didn't it?
Yes.
And as people here on your program have been saying, I mean, people left the country because there was no work. We were accustomed to seeing in the windows in houses in my life, well, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the sign "No Blacks, No Irish." And that's 40, 50 years after these events we're talking about. So for many decades, Ireland remained very poor compared to the north. And the reasons for its recent success, of course, lie in Europe. And, I mean, that's a very complicated argument, but maybe not one for now. Whether it is well-founded or not, who knows? People say that the difference between between the wealthy and the poor is still as great, even though the country is seen to be comparatively well off.
Mm. PJ's calling from Danvers, Massachusetts. PJ, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom, and thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
And I also want to thank Mr. Loach. I have seen the movie, and I grew up in Ireland in the late 40s and early 50s. I came to this country in 63. And first of all, I want to say that it's certainly in sync with all the stories I heard from my grandmother and all the people in my area where I was brought up.
Were you in the south, in Cork, or where I think the film...
In County Kerry, which is next to Cork. Basically, Cork and Kerry were IRA strongholds and very anti-free state when that treaty was signed. My grandmother had a divided loyalty between admiration for Michael Collins and then, resentment for the side that he took.
Michael Collins, who had taken the more moderate line there.
Michael Collins, who joined the Free State and, signed the treaty and, went against the majority at the time, or at least the majority in our area. But the point I wanted to make was that, I was in school in Ireland in, the 50s, and there was very, very little history of the revolution and particularly of the Civil War taught in Irish schools during that time.
Still too sensitive then to talk about?
Very, very sensitive, involved a lot of divided loyalties and families, and the government was very afraid that this would stir up bad feelings and not afraid that it would, start things all over again, but certainly afraid that it would foster increased resentment in the north of Ireland, and which it ultimately did, obviously. It was a challenging time in Ireland because truthfully, most of the history of the Civil War and the Revolution that I learned from my grandmother and other older people in my family.
PJ, let me ask you what we've got you with Ken Loach here. You recall the scene where there's the very ruthless Anglo-Irish landowner who says that if the rebels have their way, Ireland will end up as a priest-ridden backwater. You grew up in the time he was projecting forward into. Did you see yourself growing up in a priest-ridden backwater?
Well, of course, it was predominantly Catholic, and certainly the Catholic hierarchy was part of the power structure, very much a part of the power structure, so... That, I have to say, was true. It's not true today, but it clearly was true then, yes.
PJ, thanks very much for calling. Ken Loach, there's a thumbs up to your depiction of the tensions that were there and that lingered. What's the reception been more generally in Ireland?
Well, it's been extraordinary. I'd like to say thanks, PJ, for your comments. The reception has been extraordinary, and we've had several showings that have been very emotional, and it has, though. I hate to say because it sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but it has become the most financially successful independent Irish film ever. So they've been very generous to us and very warm, and it's been a really great experience. Can I just say one thing?
Please, yes.
In response to what's been going on? I wouldn't call those who accept the treaty moderate, because moderate is there's a value implied in that.
You mean
which is
Michael
that
Collins
it's
and so
you
on.
Agree mm-hmm. with? Mm-hmm. Yes, and because we all want to be moderate, and nobody wants to be an extremist. But I think there were two finely balanced points of view, and if you call one a moderate point of view, it kind of loads people's sympathy that way in a kind of subliminal way.
Though your own characters, at least in Teddy, the brother who embraces the compromised position, the state, he tries to put it that way to his brother Damien. He says, come on, live a life, stop fighting, go off with Sinead, have kids, be a doctor, give it a rest.
Yes, yes, but would you have said that if Germany had invaded Britain or the US? Say, okay, they're only going to stay in a bit of the country, stop fighting. We wouldn't have said that in that situation.
No, I understand the terms are loaded, no question. But then, ultimately, the IRA, before things were all over, it had fierce detractors within Ireland itself. Even in the last couple of years, we've heard, the stories of women rising up and saying, this has gone too far. You've got to moderate a little. Just this last week, we saw, Gerry Adams sitting down with Ian Paisley. I guess it's a kind of moderation at work there. It can certainly, in its time, have its value, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I think it's a very complicated situation that Sinn Féin have faced, because it is now, it's been a very long, drawn-out battle. So, I can see the case for saying we have to try to erode the border by other means and have a different set of tactics, but the strategic aim has to be the same, which is that Ireland should be united and one country. It's a pity nobody ever says to Paisley and the loyalists to moderate their position. The British government has constantly appeased loyalism, and it's, to me, irrational determination to divide Ireland and to want to be both Irish and British at the same time. I mean, there's an intransigence there which has really, I think, been the cause of all the sadness for decades, which the British government has not confronted.
There's a view, and today from London, let's go to Andrew, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air with Director Ken Loach.
Oh, hey there. Hey there, Ken. Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Hi. Very well.
Good. I'm from the northeast of England. I grew up there. I left there in the late 80s. But, you know, I think England could use a lot more of Ken Loach, especially his social realism point of view. I think he's done a phenomenal job. You know, I remember growing up, you know, like I say, in the northeast in the 70s in England, and in high school, like my comprehensive school, they would play for us Cares and, you know, some of John Schlesinger's Billy Liar and Kind of Lovin'. And I think I think England needs a lot more of that, you know, from the Dennis Potter to the John Schlesinger's point of view. We get far too much of the Guy Ritchie kind of a concept coming out of England now, which I think do a lot to kind of like demean the British culture in that point of view. So I don't know. I just want to pass that opinion along and hear your comments.
But Andrew, let me ask you: do you think that? I mean, this film, as I understand, Ken Loach has only opened on something like 41 screens in the UK and Ireland. That compared to 300 screens in France. Is that still general British resistance to this view of history?
No, it wasn't quite that. There was 40 odd in Britain,
okay.
But then 70 plus in Ireland.
Okay, good, I understand. But still, just 40 in Britain, that is kind of a tight pipeline you were shoved into there. Not much of an opening.
No. Well, I mean, British cinema is traditionally very dominated by American films. You know, if a film doesn't have an American accent, it's not really seen as a proper film in many cases. And the multiplexes, in particular, are dominated by American films. And for a British film to get any purchase, it has to be something that is... Or it tends to be something which is almost made for export, you know, about the royal family or about Jane Austen or something where the British dress up for the approval of the export market, you know, a bit like Africans used to perform their dances for the old colonizers, and I think it's difficult to make films that really come out of our experience and reflect our culture, independent of what the people across the Atlantic would like.
Andrew, some of the press has just been in a huge lather about this film, hating this portrayal. Does that mean a general British resistance to the Ken Loach view of the world, or is that just the right-wing press speaking?
That's a good question. I think over the years, Tom, you know, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, but I think there has been a adverse reaction to your movies. You know, I think of Lady Bird, which is quite a jarring movie. It's a beautiful portrayal, and I think Ken just does a phenomenal job of pulling the veil back on and revealing the essence of British culture. And I think it's one of those things that the government or the media, you know, are very reluctant to reveal or to allow that kind of, the essence of the working class to come out and like portray itself in a very, very realistic point of view. That's my comment.
Andrew, thanks for that. Ken?
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Andrew, for that. I mean, I think that, as I said, I think it's a different cinematic tradition. You see, in Italy, where there were the great neorealists after the Second World War, and Italian cinema has always embraced these kind of films, and French cinema has in a different way. We just have a very different cinematic tradition. the films like this have been made for television before, not so much now. But in the cinema, it's been pretty well mainstream Hollywood, and everything else has to exist on the margins.
It's all Hollywood. It's not your policy. I mean, even in Canada, the Globe and Mail saying, you know, how about a little more nuance in effect here, Ken Loach? I mean, even Satan was cut some slack, given moments of considered reflection by Milton.
But they haven't
even
seen,
Satan.
They haven't seen the film, have they? I mean, we agreed earlier that you see British soldiers who are destroyed by what they've done. You know, the officer who can't deal with things, the soldier who lets them out. But also, you know, in reply to that, the soldiers in the film are, and this guy wouldn't have known this, are all the important ones are have been serving soldiers. They're all ex-soldiers.
You mean, in life, the actors?
In life, mm-hmm. in real life, mm-hmm. they're all ex-soldiers. And I said to them, and we worked with two professional soldiers from the Irish Army and these ex-British ex-soldiers. And what I said to all of them was, how would you deal with this in a professional manner? Because that's what I want you to do. And there's no kind of personal.
That was professional.
Rage or anything
the,
like that.
The shouting, the pummeling,
absolutely.
the beating of the even
absolutely.
The women.
Absolutely, but that you see, that's what they have to do because they go into that farmyard. There could be people on the roof going to take a pot shot at them. They've got to move in fast. The wall of sound is a technique to disorientate the people they're
shout,
with,
shout,
not to give
shout,
them time
shout.
To think.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And you see them when they're arrested. Again, they're arrested for early one morning. And it's a barrage of sound. So the people you're arresting don't have a time to collect their thoughts, to do anything other than just be put where the arresting soldiers want to put them. Mm-hmm. And that's why they behave like that. And they said, this is the technique. So what you're watching is not like lunatics on the rampage. Mm. What you're watching is a technique.
Let's go to Jerry in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Jerry, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks very much for taking my call.
Yes.
I haven't seen Mr. Loach's latest film, but I can imagine that its themes are touching very closely to Iraq, because I had the opportunity to live in Denmark from 1973 to 1977, and at that time I was able to go to local cinemas and see some of Mr. Loach's films, and I regret it since coming back to America that it's not been easy to get to see his films.
Very gritty, lots of very tough social commentary in Ken Loach's work.
Yeah, but beyond that, whenever I think of Kenneth Loach, I think of the pithy comments that the New York Times film critic writes every time in the listings I see The Grapes of Wrath. He says, whoever it is, says, it's the screen at its finest. Mr. Loach has the ability to convey the human plight in a timeless and universal way, and I just want to thank him for what he's done.
Jerry,
that's very kind of you. That's very kind of you.
I have to say, in those scenes where the black and tans are shouting and confronting the Irish unarmed, the British very armed, you can feel the fear on both sides, though, in this kind of confrontation. I don't know about the parallel with Iraq, but you can't help but think of those American and British patrols in Iraq now and what they're up against, given the situation that they're in.
I think it's if you have an army of occupation, young men armed to the teeth, in knowing that they're going to that they're going into dangerous situations, you will get abuses, and you will get a cycle of violence because the army will people will attack the army because they don't want them there. The army will react. And maybe go over the top because people are scared, because it's who knows when they're going to get the next bullet. Outrages will occur because in that fevered moment, there will inevitably be those excesses. The excesses then lead to more reprisals. And I think one thing that both Ireland and situations like it and Iraq and Afghanistan have now is that if you have an army of occupation that the people don't want, there will be a downward spiral of violence, and it will end in disaster.
Well, desire hard to pluck out somehow, but the dynamic of foreign forces in a country never, ever an easy one, and you portray it extremely vividly here. Ken Loach, with us today from London, director of the new film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. We're grateful to you for the film and for your time. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, it's been a pleasure, Tom. I've got some good friends in Boston, I can tell. Well, so it was really a great pleasure to talk to you.
Well, and right across the country. Ken Loach, thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And I have lain her clay-cold corpse where I fall soon.